Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We're starting off with an email from Jane in Tacoma. Question: asthma, how can I control it? Late last June, my asthma, which I assume is allergic asthma, flared up. Since I needed my rescue inhaler a few times a day, I thought I'd start using Flovent again. My PCP had me use Flovent daily during the allergy season and went ill. It always worked, until now. I was getting 10 to 15 attacks a day, even on an increased Flovent dose, so I switched to Advair and then tried Symbicort. Since October, I've been using Symbicort 164.5. And in November, I added Spiriva. I'll comment on these drugs for your edification in just a few minutes, folks. For allergies, I take 2 Benadryl at bedtime, an Allegra in the morning, and 4 squirts of Flonase in my nose twice a day. A blood test showed that my total IgE was 254. That's quite high. And I'm allergic to maple and somewhat allergic to mugwort and western ragweed. I'm not allergic to cats, mold, or dust mites. The control has been good with the Symbicort and the Spiriva and all the allergy medicines, but I had to be on prednisone with a taper in February and March. When my asthma flares up, it's not terrible. I don't struggle for breath, but I worry about lung damage, and 10 to 15 coughing spells a day is annoying. I took my last prednisone 2 days ago and have had one mild attack. What can I do to put this behind me? It may not pertain to me, but in my various searches, I read that people who had mild to moderate COVID end up with hard-to-control asthma. I had mild COVID in the summer of 2022, but the hard-to-control asthma didn't start until the summer of 2024. Jane goes on to say that she always takes the generic of these drugs, but that she used the trade names just because they're easier to remember, because you have a whole focus group coming up with those names, would be my opinion. I'm going to start off with commenting on the possibility of the COVID. Now, nowadays, people can get a subclinical COVID. And what that means is that you didn't get that sick. Maybe you didn't even have any symptoms, but you did make the virus. Your immune system was able to fight it off. And honestly, you were taking steroids. So you might have had an exposure. You might have had a upper respiratory infection. Any virus can set off asthma. I don't know. You said you had allergy testing. I don't know if they looked at IgG. It looks like maybe they only did the IgE. And so there could be some other factor that's increased your inflammation. I'd be worried about mold, even though you're not allergic to mold, because mold toxins can be very pro-inflammatory. And I wonder if there's been any water intrusion in your home. I also have some suggestions for what you might want to do. But the first bit of advice is something that is not being done here, which you probably need to do, is to block lipooxygenase. So this is a type of inflammatory molecule closely related to the prostaglandins, which, as you know, are pro-inflammatory. That's why we take things like Motrin. Well, these leukotrienes that are made by LOX, L-oxygenase, it is a type of chemical signal that's pro-inflammatory and prolonged. It produces something called the slow-reacting substance of anaphylaxis. And this is the thing that will keep you coughing for a very long time. And so you need to plug that hole, so to speak. And the drugs to do that, the one I would recommend is one called Montelukast, and the trade name is Singulair. But before you add more drugs, for goodness sakes, go get some quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. Quercetin stabilizes the mast cells. You might also think about getting some inhaled Cromolyn, another mast cell stabilizer. And the mast cells are the thing that release the histamine. So if you can go upstream and calm those mast cells down, then the whole cascade of inflammatory signaling doesn't happen. And it sounds like you might be in a loop. You could, if there has been any leaks or any suggestion of, leaks in the roof, or if you've had the bathtub on the second floor overflow, you may have some mold growing between the joists or something. So I can't speak to it specifically, but you could get environmental testing for mold. And the testing to get would be called ERMI, E-R-M-I testing. There's a number of outfits that do that, I'm sure, because you're in the Pacific Northwest, that there's a booming business in mold finding. Another way that you could look for mold would be to send away or have your doctor send away for a test and then check your urine and see if you have a high level of mold breakdown products in your urine. If you do, then you should go on a little mold hunt. It doesn't have to be an allergy. It can just be a direct irritant. So I hope that's helpful. The quercetin dose that I typically recommend is somewhere between 800 milligrams to 1,000 milligrams a day. And it's given the other things you're on, that would probably be the first place I would go. Then looking into that inhaled Cromolyn, which is a prescription medication. It is available. Again, wanting to stabilize those mast cells and the montelukast to reduce the slow-reacting substance of anaphylaxis, the leukotrienes. So I hope that's been helpful, and thank you very much for your email, and please let me know how that works out. So this email came from Lloyd, who didn't say where he's sending it from. Lloyd said, new publications about mechanisms of age-related bone deterioration. Very interesting. I learned some things, so thank you, Lloyd. And I'm going to share what I learned with you. Scientists and researchers around the globe are investigating a series of mysteries about what happens to our bones over time. In a new study, a team led by the University of Texas at Austin, in collaboration with Mayo Clinic and Cedars-Sinai, made a major break in the case. New research found that osteocytes undergo dramatic structural and functional changes with age that impair their ability to keep our bones strong. This could pave the way to better treatments for osteoporosis, and it's a step forward in the new science of cellular senescence. And so osteocytes and osteoblasts are the cells that both build up bone and break down bone. But the osteocytes are also driving. They're in control of the breaking down and the building of bone. So senescent cells are cells that have stopped dividing, but they aren't, they haven't died. They haven't undergone that programmed cell death, apoptosis. So as a result, they're hanging out. They're secreting chemical signals that essentially affect the cytoskeleton of their own cells, but also surrounding cells. And the you think of cells as like an amoeba, just this sort of, I guess I would say a gel bag of stuff, but it's actually nothing like that. The cells have all kinds of little struts and girders that are forming and changing and breaking down and reforming, and that's what allows a cell like an amoeba to move. It's actually building scaffolding and then breaking it down behind it. And this is happening very rapidly, and these cytoskeleton network is what allows for the transport of nutrients. It allows for signals. It allows for cell division. It's very, very important. And a healthy cytoskeleton is flexible. It when your cytoskeleton gets stiff and it can't break down and rebuild quickly, well, then the outside walls of the plasma membrane become stiff. They lose their viscoelasticity. So their stretchy elasticity, their resistance, they move, but they move slowly like a thick syrup, right? And that actually sends a chemical signal to the DNA of what through more cytoskeletons and structures within the nucleus and turns on and off, among other things, cellular reproduction. And if you think about the last time you got goo in your inner ear from a cold and you couldn't hear anything, and certain people develop a type of deafness where the little bones in their middle ear actually become sclerotic or scarred and don't move properly, and that doesn't allow the sound to get from the outside world to your brain because it has to pass through those bones. So if you can imagine that the cell is getting stiff and losing its elasticity, and this is causing the chemical signals made in the nucleus that direct the whole process of bone growth from working. So as the scaffolding becomes rigid and less flexible, the building, if you think of this as a building, this would be like the structural struts inside a building. The stiffened osteocytes can't effectively regulate bone remodeling because they can't send the signal to the nucleus to make the compounds that do that. I mentioned that senescent cells release a toxic brew of molecules. This is called the senescence-associated secretory phenotype. And our technology now is so good that we can amplify and study these molecules. The presence of these SASPs has been linked to many chronic diseases and cancer. And you may remember a few years ago, there was a vogue for transfusing yourself with young type-specific blood. And they were doing all sorts of blood transfusion, you know, hooking an old animal up to a young one and showing that the old animal got rejuvenated and the epigenetics on the younger animal actually accelerated. So essentially, you were diluting the SASP across two organisms who were had their bloodstreams hooked together. And so the old one that was making all of the SASP got better because it got diluted in their blood or in the mixed blood. But the young one actually got older because because this was a biological transfer. Now, in humans, it was just a one-way transfer. So aside from using up some iron and making the young person a little more tired, they didn't, for a day or two, they didn't have any adverse effects. But it almost became a kind of, well, the one percenters are going to have their, you know, they're going to have their butler and their maid, and they're going to have a couple of blood boys that they draw blood off, make sure those guys stay healthy so they don't catch anything from them, but just, you know, kind of rejuvenate their blood. Turns out that actually has some problems long, you know, over the anything but the immediate term. So I don't think that's going to continue to be a thing if it ever did become one. But this focus on cell mechanics as a way to study aging is a very, very different approach. Much like physical therapy helps restore movements when our joint stiffens, maybe we can use mechanical cues to help reverse or even, okay, hold on a minute, help reverse or even selectively clear aging cells. Now, we do have some senolytic therapies currently. The most common one, the one that shows the best promise is actually a combination, oddly enough, of quercetin and dasatinib. So it's called D&Q therapy and dasatinib, which is D-A-S-A-T-I-N-I-B, is a chemotherapy agent. And when you combine those two, you block the formation of these SASPs, senescence-associated secretory phenotypes. There's also a bioflavonoid, fisetin, F-I-S-E-T-A-N, which has shown promise as well. And because it's a flavonoid, it's going to be much safer. And a very cheap generic drug is also on the list of the three most studied senolytic therapies, and that's metformin. And metformin, of course, is used for diabetes, but it turns out to have a it does turn out to help with reducing the progress of senescence of cells. So the idea that you could maybe treat osteoporosis or prevent it by sending mechanical signals into the bones is not so new, because that's what we do when we walk and when we go up in orbit and live on the space station. That's the thing that doesn't happen. And so we know that not loading your bones changes the electrical signals from the crystal in the hydroxyapatite, which is calcium hydroxyapatite, is the sort of crystalline form that you have there in your bones. But this formation thing, this conformation change and the impact it has is just being studied. It makes me sort of rethink those vibration plates, you know, the ones that some gyms have and some chiropractors' offices have. The problem is, just like with the magnetic brain stimulation or the electrical brain stimulation, what we don't know is what frequency. It would be sort of like trying to find the right radio frequency without knowing what it was. I think about the old ham radio operators. My uncle did that, and he would sit there hunched over his radio at night in dim light, and he'd turn the thing minutely, trying to tune in some voice from Taiwan or some voice from France. And it was very moody. The sounds sort of static, and then a little bit of voice would emerge. Well, we need to know what channel to tune to in order to be able to apply these things as not only which way to point our antenna, which is important, but what frequency to be using. And that's where the science needs to go on everything from magnetic brain stimulation to vibration plates. Okay, well, we have our first caller. Please tell me what your name is and where you're calling from, and turn down your radio if it's still on.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
This is Sibyl.
Oh, hello, Sibyl.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, I did. I got that wonderful, cool little card that you sent me. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. I'm from SoCal. Yes. But you know my story, you know, sepsis, osteomyelitis, staph aureus in the eyes.
Yes.
So and now all of a sudden, out of the blue, I mean, my blood pressure was always great, always like around 105, 108, stuff like that. And all of a sudden, I have high blood pressure. And it goes up to like 146, and then it goes down again to like 135. This morning, it was actually down to 127. I always have low heart rate. I mean, it's under 50 or like 49. 48, something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is really going on, I think I really have PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid that I'm going to be blind.
Oh yeah, I mean your eyes are one of the places that it causes great fear when they're threatened. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I couldn't even see my face in the mirror at Sanford Hospital. They couldn't see my retina. I had fog for 2 months. I just had a thick fog in front of my eyes. So I just think this is the delayed response to stress, this high blood pressure. I don't see any other way except, and maybe you can help me with that.
Mm-hmm.
I read on AI that when the microbiome is, damaged or whatever, non-existent, that can cause high blood pressure. So I don't know. It can either be one or the other or both. I don't know.
Well, in functional medicine, there's usually multiple things going on. I have another couple of things that I would want you to consider. So let finish up, though.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any further questions, or should I just start?
No, I'm just saying that I'm doing everything for the microbiome. I'm eating lots of root vegetables. I'm taking the ultradophils. I'm taking cashew coconut yogurt, and I meditate, and I don't know. I'm doing everything I can for both for stress and for microbiome.
So, okay. All right. Yeah. So one of the things that you haven't mentioned that I think we really need to think about is that your body was fighting off a massive infection, right?
Yes.
And so that creates a lot of what we call oxidative stress. Mm-hmm. And the oxidative stress is in the form of oxygen-free radicals, and they are generated, among other things, by the chemicals that your white blood cells use to kill the bacteria. And mm-hmm. so you get a spill, if you will, kind of a toxic spill of the residua and that goes into your lymph system and gets dumped into your bloodstream and then cleared by your liver and your spleen. Great. But while it's mm-hmm. circulating in the tubes of your bloodstream, it can actually impact the endothelium, which are the very important cells that line the inside of the blood vessels. And we used to kind of conceptualize blood vessels as pipes, but they're actually much closer to the way that the gut works, where you have these muscles, and the muscles are controlled by nerves in the walls, and the muscles contract and relax depending upon what signal they've been given by the control cells. And in the case of the vasculature lining, these endothelial cells, the chemical signal that they produce to cause the muscles to relax, which is going to lower your blood pressure, is a compound very short-lived in the bloodstream called nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is, you can think of it almost as a neurotransmitter. It's a short-lived signal. It is critical to things like, well, the human male erection, for example, relies on it. Your ability to open up your vasculature when you have higher demand, like when you're running or climbing stairs. And so you probably did sustain an endothelial injury. And the sudden, whatever the source of it was, this is something that you can actually work at reversing. So the blood pressures that you're telling me don't sound too terribly dangerously high, and you haven't mentioned that you've been started on any medications.
No, not yet.
You have a cuff. You have a blood pressure cuff.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Every day I take it twice a day, but you know, the thing is, every time I look at that machine, I'm already nervous, and that gets my blood pressure up. But then I check it 3 minutes later and it goes down.
Yeah. Well, what I would do is I would put the machine on and sit mm-hmm. there for 5 minutes,
and let
yourself get bored, and then hit the button. Okay. Mm-hmm. So step one is you have to habituate to it. You know, the scary picture on the wall that startles you the first time you see it, but the 20th time you see it, it's wallpaper. And mm-hmm. so you need to turn the cuff into wallpaper through effectively desensitization. And you're supposed to sit for 5 minutes before you check your blood pressure anyway. So you're just doing good technique. Also make sure the cuff fits. You know, it has to wrap around your hand around your arm 1.5 times. Don't use a wrist mm-hmm. cuff, use an arm cuff. They're more mm-hmm. accurate. And start eating beetroot and other foods that are high in, you said you're eating root vegetables, so maybe you're already doing this, but I would try I would try specifically for high nitrogen foods. So high nitrate mm-hmm. foods. That would be a really important thing. And there's an amino acid that helps make nitric oxide, and it's called L-arginine. So you can put that in if you do a protein smoothie or you eat yogurt or porridge. You can add...
Because I'm not at home. Can you tell me that again? L-arginine?
Yeah, that's one of the essential amino acids. Mm-hmm. And that one in particular is it stimulates the enzyme the production of the enzyme that makes the nitric oxide. Mm-hmm. So it's an indirect effect. It's an amino acid. It's totally safe to take five grams of that a day. I usually have people take 4 to 5 grams, okay, and eat the equivalent of a quarter to a half cup of beets or some other nitrogen-rich food every day so that you've got the nitrogen, which is another cofactor. Mm-hmm. And that will help the so-called DASH diet. I mean, I know you from previous calls, and we've met, so I know that good, you eat a high vegetable diet, that you're getting lots of healthy bioflavonoids. Mm-hmm. I think I would add, I would throw in potassium and calcium. It might be worthwhile to take potassium chloride, which you can mm-hmm. buy as a sprinkle, or you can simply buy in capsules. And mm-hmm. the dose of potassium chloride is about a teaspoon. So
I read that potassium, I read on AI, you shouldn't take potassium because of, not good for the kidneys or something.
That's context. People who have bad kidneys can't clear potassium well from their blood. Okay. Mm-hmm. But potassium, in high blood pressure, potassium is usually low, and it won't be low in the blood, because mm-hmm. the most of the potassium in your body is inside the cells. Most of the sodium is outside the cells. And to make a nerve or a muscle fire, one of the things that happens is that ions, which are either positively or negatively charged particles, move. In the case of your nerves, and remember, nerves are critical to relaxing the blood vessels, you need that potassium so that at a high level inside the nerve so that it can exit quickly, and that sends a signal to the muscles that's stronger and causes them to relax. So you can you won't get into trouble with potassium very easily. And when I say when I talk about a teaspoon of potassium chloride, I'm talking about 5 grams. When we treat someone with a diuretic or something that's going to deplete their body of potassium, we typically are giving them we're giving them something like 20 or 30 grams. So it's really, okay, you need to kind of relax about the potassium and see if that, you can try the nitric oxide first, but if you've got a normal BUN creatinine, or you look at your labs, and your GFR, for people over 65, if their GFR is above 45, they're going to handle the potassium just fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. They've got plenty of, the kidney doesn't want your potassium in your blood to be high, because that can kill you. I mean, you can kill yourself by taking a massive overdose of potassium chloride. In fact, some of the injection executions actually use potassium chloride. But it's industrial quantities, so you'll be fine. Yeah. And if you're a little nervous about it, that's fine. Take some extra calcium, and maybe just buy the Morton salt substitute or new salt, and use that instead of salt in your cooking.
Mm-hmm. Very little salt. And I also eat lots of potassium-rich foods. I try to do that.
Yes. Well, I'm suggesting what I think might be available on the understanding that you eat that diet, as I said when we started.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
All right.
Can I ask you real quick?
Yes.
I'm taking a few supplements, if that's good to take. It's olive leaf extract, grapeseed extract, natto kinase, ashwagandha, and hawthorn.
Okay.
So
those are all fine, and they are not going to lower your blood pressure, but they are, I mean, they're, maybe the hawthorn might help a little bit with your cellular perfusion. Mm-hmm. One of the things, but the ashwagandha is good for your adrenal glands and helps with sleep. I mean, they're all legitimate herbs, and they aren't causing your blood pressure to go up. You got to watch the licorice.
Yeah.
So if you're taking, I had one lady once who was taking like 6 different Chinese herbs, and they all had for qi deficiency, and she, you know, she ended up toxic on licorice. So you got to be careful with that one. But that's about the only herb that really has substantial impact on blood pressure, excluding cocaine, which is technically an herb.
But you mean olive leaf extract and grapeseed extract, they won't lower my, or natto? How about natto, though?
Well, okay, natto is a is good for preventing clotting. It's it's a thrombolytic. And the other two that you're mentioning are potent antioxidants. So if there was ongoing oxidative stress, but it's kind of like the fire burns the house, the fire is gone, but the house is still burnt and has to, in the case of, let's say the fire burns the grassland. So the grassland's burnt for a long time until it can grow back. And in the case of the endothelial cells, after a period of oxidative stress, they're less efficient at making that nitric oxide, and that may be where the blood pressure lability is coming from. Okay. And yes, you probably do have some PTSD, and that triggers the spasm of the blood vessel, and then the nitric oxide isn't able to relax it as quickly as it used to be. And we're off to the races with that white coat hypertension.
Yeah, I know. I'm meditating more now, so I hope that helps too.
Well, good luck, and I'm happy to keep you posted. Get that exercise. That's also really helpful, and I know you do. Bye for now, Sybil.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thanks, Dr. Brown. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
This next email comes from David in Kansas City, Missouri. And David wants to know if there are ways that cartilage loss can be prevented with aging. So we were just talking about bones, and osteoarthritis is what happens when the cartilage that caps the bones at the joints, essentially, it's a lubricant, if you will, but it's a solid lubricant, and it lets the bones slide over each other rather than grind together like sandpaper. And things that drive osteoarthritis, there are a number of them, but probably the most important ones are obesity and injury. Now, in the case of obesity, it's effectively just exceeding the design specifications and carrying around extra weight is going to wear the tires down. There are agents that people are trying now. You'll hear about injecting stem cells or injecting cord blood or injecting platelet-rich plasma, and those do help with symptoms, but it doesn't really look like they necessarily rebuild cartilage. They are anti-inflammatory. So just like we were talking with our last caller about how this oxidative stress accelerates aging, oxidative stress will certainly certainly accelerate aging of all tissues, including cartilage. The other issue is injury. So these cartilage plates grow very smooth. In fact, when we are an embryo, our bones are all cartilage. They're just a cartilage blueprint, if you will, in the shape of the eventual bone. And it's after birth that we began to mineralize most of those bones. I mean, we have a little mineral in our bones, but they're very, very soft in infancy. This is about glucosamine sulfate and the research that's been done. And there have been a number of very interesting studies. There's also been studies that didn't show benefit, but I think a lot of that has to do with the way the study was set up, including what kind of formulations they used. So there was a study done by the NIH in the United States where they looked, it was called the GAIT trial, G-A-I-T, and it looked at placebo versus glucosamine hydrochloride, the dose being 1,500 milligrams or 500 milligrams three times a day, and they looked at combining those for knee pain. The indicator that they used wasn't cartilage thickness in the study. It was knee pain. But The study showed a trend towards improvement in knee pain. But my favorite glucosamine study was a study where they didn't look at pain, because pain is notoriously difficult to measure. They looked at radio x-rays. And, you know, you might, your subjective response or perception of pain can be influenced by your attitude, and therefore it's more subject to the placebo effect. However, your x-ray is probably not subject to a placebo effect, at least not directly. So there are two double-blinded three-year trials. That means that the radiologists who were looking at the x-rays did not know if the people were taking glucosamine sulfate, and the people were taking identical supplements. They did not know what was in the supplements. And remember I said that inconclusive study used glucosamine hydrochloride? Well, this used glucosamine sulfate in both of those. And they looked at the change in the minimum joint space width on an x-ray. Now, that's like taking a photograph. You put a, let's say, a tape measure on the floor and from the wall, and you stand directly on the 4-foot line, and you lean up against the wall, and you take a photograph of that person's knees. And they're always going to stand in the same place, and you're always going to stand in the same place. So if there's a change over time, you can believe it. Now, there was one study in Belgium and one study in Prague, and they showed a relative risk reduction for the need to undergo osteoarthritis surgery, that is to say knee replacement, with a risk ratio of 0.52. Now, that means it cut the risk of needing an operation in half. And in the Prague study, there was a 73% reduction in this. And these have very high significance. The Prague study was 0.001. Let me tell you, 0.01 is good. 0.001 means that it's just so unlikely that this is due to chance that you can pretty much take it as true, unless, of course, they falsified the data. And that's why we have peer review for scrutiny. So another study looked at just how high can oral glucosamine sulfate go. And they found that if you took if you took the 1500 milligrams, you got levels in the plasma and that were quite high. And if you were taking it regularly, tenfold difference between serum and synovial fluids. In other words, it concentrated in the synovial knee joint, and that makes sense, because glucosamine sulfate is a class of chemical that is gooey, and it's part of what's used to make synovial fluid. Just like that hyaluronic acid is a glycosaminal glycan. We put those into people's knees. It's a Synovisc is the name of the therapy. There's probably a competing brand, but that's the one I remember. And and the hyaluronic acid acts as a lubricant. So it makes sense that if you can put it in through the gut, we probably shouldn't be putting it in through a joint injection. And so the thing that I really want to emphasize is that the negative trials used 503 times a day, whereas the positive trials used 1,500, and they used a different compound. So glucosamine hydrochloride, 503 times a day, doesn't work. Glucosamine sulfate, 1,500 milligrams once a day, did work, and this is over several studies. So when someone says, oh, well, that was shown not to work, you got to go, okay, let me look at the methods section and compare exactly what was given, how was it given, and then we'll decide whether you can refute one of these studies with the others. And I do want to say that Americans tend to weigh more, so it wouldn't surprise me if that's another reason that the American levels are the studies don't show as strong a benefit. I also just want to say, if you want to prevent knee progression of knee arthritis to the point where you need a knee replacement, you should get your body weight down. And if that means maybe using one of these new injectable drugs, well, maybe that's what you need to do if you want to avoid this. And I think it's so important that we be at a healthy body weight. I mean, I talk about all these drugs and I talk about all these herbs and, you know, the basics, right? Adequate sleep, adequate exercise, healthy body weight, healthy diet. There's not a, you know, you can go to the health food store and buy everything on the shelves and you will not be able to make up for not checking all three of those boxes in terms of your longevity. It's just extremely important for me to emphasize that, because I know I talk about supplements a lot, but there's no substitute for the basics. Okay, Eric in Santa Cruz writes, thoughts on possibly changing my primary care physician before retirement. I've heard it's hard to change your primary care physician while on Medicare. What's your advice choice for a primary care physician prior to retiring? Should I have a PCP that is also not so close to retiring too? Yes. I may need to change my PCP in 7 years from now, no matter what. So I guess I would say, Eric, you're planning ahead, and I don't know why you would need to change in 7 years. But one of the things, if you're planning to move to another area, establish care while you're visiting. Okay, like if you're going to go move near your sister or something, then go to a doctor there, give your sister's address, healthy guy, 67, you're just coming in for a checkup. Now you're on the books as a patient, right? So years later, when you show up in the office, you are already an established patient. So if that's the plan, that's important. Try to choose someone who has been where they are in that particular clinic. And this goes for here or there, who has been there for about 3 to 4 years. When doctors first come to an area, particularly now that doctors are employees, they get a signing bonus and they come to the area and they may discover that bonus doesn't go, that the salary doesn't go as far as they thought it would, or their life circumstances may change. After 3 to 4 years, have usually settled into a community and they're likely to not leave. And that's super important. How can you figure out the doctor? Well, you know, which one do you want? You mentioned that you're looking for, that you're looking for a doctor that maybe has the ability to give you some alternative advice or advise you on nutrition, or, you know, maybe not just immediately pull out the prescription pad. And so I would say, look at the LinkedIn profiles of the doctors with open practices and that are taking new Medicare patients. And that'll, in our community, it's a fairly short list, except for the very young ones whom, like I said, you may not get to keep. So when someone, you know, you're looking for a specific profile, and then, you know, hopefully they say something in their LinkedIn profile or on the website that appeals to you, like maybe you have similar hobbies or something that might build rapport. You also say, unlike most, I have an option to stay part of my large employer's health plan after retirement. It's somehow infused with Medicare. Yes, all employee plans will have they'll dance a jig when you go to Medicare, because it gets much cheaper, your boss will anyway, because it gets much cheaper to have that employee. But you want to avoid Medicare Advantage plans, because Medicare Advantage locks you into a specific panel, and that includes your specialty panel. And you sound like you're employed and you could definitely handle paying for your own glasses. And I really encourage people to stay away from Medicare Advantage. It's difficult to get out of it, because the entities that employ the doctors get more money from Medicare Advantage. So they like to keep you in there once you're in. And you may find yourself high and dry and having to travel to the next town for a doctor. So I seriously would advise to be careful as you make these changes. Hope that helps. Going on to our next email, and we're going to go to Joey in San Luis Obispo, California. And Joey writes, "Thank you for sharing your expertise, experience, and research with us. I'm a 60-year-old female with a life history of lots of exercise, good eating habits, solid lab results, and that changed 2 years ago. I went through a 3-month acute stressful situation, after which my naturopathic doctor ran labs because I wasn't feeling well. My thyroid was high, and I was anemic. My naturopath put me on a supplement regimen and also tested me for EBV antibodies. Sure enough, the Epstein-Barr virus in my system had been reactivated." And she goes on to give the numbers, both which show, to interpret it, that she has had it in the past, and that the numbers, the titers, as we would call, were pegged at at greater than the maximum reporting level. So she was, you know, 2, maybe 3 standard deviations out there, probably. So after a few months of supplement regimen and additional rest, my thyroid came back into balance and has remained in balance. A couple of ultrasounds apart, she ruled out thyroid nodules. The anemia got better. But for the last 2 years, my EBV labs haven't changed. They continue to show greater than the maximal reporting levels. All of my other labs are in the normal range. And for the last 2 years, my fatigue limits my ability to live a life like I was accustomed. I usually have to take naps just to make it through the day. And for 2 years, I'm tired of feeling so tired. For your information, my NP has me on the following supplements: vitamin D, 1,500 units per week. I'll have something to say about that. Vitamin A, 20,000 units per week. That's fine. If you're 60, you're not going to get pregnant and hurt the fetus. And an antiviral tincture consisting of astragalus, cat's claw, mahonia, and melissa. I've not had any vaccines in the last 2 years, so as not to strain my immune system. I'm not thinking that's that wise. I would certainly keep up on the flu shots, especially with this H5N1 sort of hovering out there. And it's fallen out of the news because of the stock market stuff and the tariffs. But that's, you know, it's the standard movie trope. The truck that hits you is you're looking in the other direction and it T-bones you. Well, you know, we could get T-boned any time by that one. So let's start with the fact that your doctor is measuring antibodies against EBV. He's not measuring EBV. If you have EBV reactivation, then you will have a positive DNA PCR. This is the PCR to get viral load is what we do for monitoring AIDS patients and their response to their drugs. And so you want to see if you actually have a viral load before you make this assumption, because it could potentially be a false assumption. I mentioned earlier that COVID and long COVID are a possibility here. I will point out that when your thyroid got high, that was probably because you had an autoimmune or a viral attack that damaged your thyroid. And it wasn't working well, just like those endothelial cells aren't putting out what they need to be putting out. You were anemic. Your bone marrow wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. So this may have been something else besides EBV reactivation. And what we do see with COVID is a whole lot of antibodies get activated, like ANA, the lupus one, and TPO, which is the Hashimoto's one. So getting a total IG panel, and this is IgA, IgG, IgE, that's a simple blood test, standard lab test. Getting a fibrinogen, because these will tell you, if they're up, these will tell you that you have some version of chronic inflammatory response syndrome, which leads to a sort of chronic disease. And there's a lot of things, chronic fatigue. There's a lot of things that cause chronic fatigue. The other things to think about, I'd probably get checked for mold. Maybe your doctor did that. But in long COVID, for the audience, you're going to have elevated IgGs, elevated fibrinogen. You may even have low-grade elevations of cancer markers like CA-125, CA-919, CEA. These are things that we monitor in cancer to monitor the progress of our therapy, and only cancers make them. But in long COVID, you get increased levels of all sorts of inflammatory things, not to the level of disease, but they pop up. So high normal ranges of cancer markers might be another clue for long COVID, which we have to keep on our differential. I also think you should look for mold and Lyme, as I mentioned. I've already talked about this, but just to reiterate, the easiest way, probably the cheapest ways to look for mold is to look for how much mold antigen there is in your body. And you do that by peeing into a cup and sending it off to the Great Smokies lab. They have a test called Mycotox. I think you have to get a doctor to order it for you, but your naturopath is a practitioner. And so I would look for those. Assuming that you do not find elevated mold, and we're not doing a full mold workup here, we're just looking for the presence, not the mold toxin syndrome. That's a whole rabbit hole. Think about LDN, low-dose naltrexone, which I have found to be very helpful in long COVID. I also want you to get your vitamin D level up to 90 to 100, because that's what modulates the immune system, and it's a safe level. You're going to have to, I don't know if the 1500 is doing it, and 1500 once a week I don't like, because that's more than your body can produce in a day. And if you're doing it one day a week, you may actually downregulate your vitamin D receptors and shoot yourself in the foot. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.